McCoy Westbrook is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Westbrook to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for nearly half of all executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, Chief Legal Analyst Jim Skelton, with Legal Analysts Larry Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Danielle Allen. Houston Vigil reporter, Jennifer Simmons. Tonight's show will include an exclusive in-depth interview with Westbrook, taped several weeks ago. The Execution Watch for Coy Westbrook begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. Welcome to the show. Thank you, Larry, for that a wonderful voice in the introduction. Danielle is awaiting, so Danielle? Danielle? Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Hello, Danielle. What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, they're playing the music over at the warden's house right now, which signifies that the execution's fixing to start. The witnesses haven't walked through yet, though. We're waiting for them.
Okay, but you have every reason to believe this procedure is going to continue. There's not really anything pending in Westbrook's cases.
No, there isn't. The attorneys have not filed anything. It is going through. He's going to have three witnesses this evening, one being Pat. That's why I'm taking her place, and two other longtime friends of his. He has a daughter who is currently at the hospitality house, very grieving, obviously, but the execution will proceed.
Are y'all? Do y'all have weather there?
Oh, yes, it's raining very hard, but we're out here protesting. Some of the usual people are here. Gloria's here, the professor, same people, the hardcore abolitionists are here.
Well, I give the vigilants our regards for braving the weather, and they're standing up for principle. And thank you very much for this report. We're going to check on a vigil here in Houston and then go on with the show.
All right. Thank you.
If you have anything to report, call Elizabeth.
I sure will. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Jennifer, are you there?
Yes, Ray. I am here. It's raining pretty hard. We have some good wind that gusts up. Occasionally, we're here in front of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church, Alabama, at Woodhead. There's only a few of us, and it's pretty miserable out here, but not nearly as miserable as it is up in Huntsville, I'm sure. So,
well, give the vigilants our regards for their stamina and standing up for the weather. And Danielle reports that the witnesses have not yet crossed the road.
Oh, okay.
But there is no reason for that to be delayed any longer, so it's going to happen soon.
Well, we just wish that the state of Texas would come up with some credible scientific peer review standards for making sure that we're not violating the provisions of Adkins under the Supreme Court. That's my feeling about this case.
Thank you, ma'am. Stay dry as you can.
Okay, we'll try.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And so, Coy Wayne Westerbrook, Jim, you actually interviewed.
Sure did.
Any impressions about that?
As you well know from the interviews we've done before, most people don't want to talk about what happened. It makes them look bad. And those that do talk about it usually try to minimize things, which is only a normal reaction. What is unbelievable to me about Coy was he had no guile. He did not try to excuse anything. In fact, when I talked to him, the first thing that came to my mind was the character Lenin of Mice and Men, because one of the issues was his mental condition. And he was almost childlike in the sense he didn't. Everything he told me that occurred absolutely matched up almost word for word with the facts developed at trial. He didn't try to alibi. He tried to blame anybody. He just told exactly what happened.
We have that interview, and it's a long interview. We're going to begin it now.
What does that mean?
Sink.
Don't have a slap board.
Start all over again. My name is Jim Scales. Let me tell you why we're up here. We're up here primarily for you to say anything you feel or think. We're not up here kind of, everything you say is going to go on the air. Mm-hmm. We're not going to censor anything. We're not going to cut anything out. So please feel free to talk as free as you want to. My only question is, now we were talking about this earlier, where in the world did you get the nickname Elvis?
Well, like I said, Alvin Andrew Kelly gave me that name. He was a death row inmate up here in 2008. They executed him. And he was born in 1951. So we became pretty good friends. And a lot of us up here, you know, we become spiritual people.
Sure, sure, that's natural.
And Alvin was a spiritual person, and we elected him as our spiritual leader.
I see.
So one day I was out in the day room. This is when I used to go to the day room all the time. I've since quit going to the day room. he had a advertisement out of a magazine, and he said, "You're now Elvis." And it was an Elvis impersonator eating a 10-foot Subway sandwich. So he said, "Every time I look at this guy, I think of you."
That's interesting.
So I said, "Well, I don't know why you're thinking of me. I don't even eat that much." But
well, I wanted to let you know I made the pilgrimage to Graceland once, so we have something in common.
Well, there's some people who can call me Graceland.
I understand. One thing I was curious about, and I wanted you to talk about it, what really bothered me when I read your case is we have a provision in our statute, as you well know, that if somebody acts under sudden passion from something that would make anybody angry or lose control, it's much like temporary insanity. For example, if you something happens to you where you just lose it, and during that period of time that you lost it and you killed somebody, that's called sudden passion. And that issue is submitted at punishment, and they reduce the sentence down, reduce it from down to 20 years. And that was not available in your trial. And I think that's outrageous, because I think from all I've read, this is absolutely a crime. That was offense that was committed during something that would enrage anybody. That any normal human being went through what you went through that night would have lost it. And apparently you attempted to leave and someone took your keys away and you came back in and caught your wife making out with another man, making love to her, as a matter of fact, another man, and you killed him. And that's a classic example of sudden passion. I think it's terribly unfair that that was not submitted in your trial. Would you have to comment on that?
Well, the reason it wasn't allowed is because I killed four people before I killed her and him in the bedroom.
It was after you had seen her. It's not, correct me if I'm in error. You didn't kill anybody. You saw your wife making out with this other man, right?
Right.
Okay, so I'm talking about. Now, that to me would enrage any normal human being. And then you killed during that sudden passion. That's what I thought was unfair about your trial.
Well, you can also thank Jan Crocker, because she wouldn't allow it.
Jan Crocker, I've known her for years, tried a case against her. Her name, she deserves the name of Crocker. That's a class. And you know, I was thinking about your case. You drew the worst judges possible. Jan Crocker is your trial judge, and that idiot Mansfield on the Court of Criminal Appeals wrote the majority opinion. And Mansfield was run off after 6 years, and he got the best job he could get when he left the court was a security guard, and they fired him from that. And you got some terrible luck on getting Jan Crocker as your trial judge, and then getting Mansfield to write the opinion in the Court of Criminal Appeals. That is just terrible, terrible luck.
Well, that, and I didn't have the greatest attorney.
Well, who is your lawyer? I didn't find out who your lawyer was at trial.
The trial attorneys were, the lead attorney was Wayne T. Hill, and the second seat attorney was Robert Kent Loper.
Robert Loper and Wayne Hill, okay.
And I don't know if you know them or not.
Well, I know, you know, we all know each other, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. I know Hill fairly well, and Loper I just know casually.
Well, I know that Wayne used to work for the prosecutor's office before he ever took my case. And if I would have known that, I certainly wouldn't have let him take my case. But then again, all these trial attorneys down there worked in one way or the other for the prosecutors. So,
well, as you well know, one of the big problems we have, especially is that virtually all the judges are former prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guarantee you, on our benches in Texas, a vast majority of them go from being a prosecutor, and the next day they're a judge.
Right.
And then what they do is they appoint their people they worked with in the office before. It's a very corrupt system in that sense, is that they, all of them are former prosecutors, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree there. There's a lot of corruption in the justice system. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's broke. I mean, definitely.
Because what's interesting about your case, I do a lot of these death penalty cases. I read a lot of them, as you know. Most of them have a record of being in and out of jail, going to prison, being in trouble. You had absolutely nothing like that in your background, did you?
Nope. Didn't. I wasn't a criminal. Most of my friends were deputy sheriff, constables, fire marshals. Some of them were FBI agents. I had a couple that were Texas Rangers. And
did any of them volunteer to come and help you during the trial?
I had one HPD officer who testified in my trial, and I found out about 2 years ago that I guess it was Mr. Nielsen, who was the lead prosecutor in my trial,
mm-hmm.
filed a letter of recommendation on him to the chief of police, saying that he was working against the system and that he wasn't a very good officer. So instead of allowing him to progress up the ladder, and because he was in pursuit of becoming a drug enforcement officer.
It was the DEA?
Yeah. And they wouldn't let him, on the count of that letter, he was blackballed, basically.
And all he did was testify as a character witness for you, correct? Is
mm-hmm.
that it?
Yeah. Yeah. And he didn't say anything in the trial that exactly, other than I was a good person, we'd worked extra jobs before together, I always showed up on time, but other than that, I was just a good person.
I take it you must have done some security work then.
Yeah.
And had you wanted to be a police officer, had that been one of your goals?
Yeah. We used to ride around a lot together. I'd be riding as an observer with him, and I got to go on a lot of dope investigations and things, and seeing how the detectives did their work. And I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I'm glad I didn't become a cop, because they do a lot of dirty dealings.
You know, and comment on this, if you would. I was a prosecutor. One of the things that I've learned in dealing, especially with policemen, they feel if it's a bad person, whatever they need to do is justified. That whole idea of the ends justify the means. Has that been your experience?
As long as I was riding with him, it was.
Because it seems to me that, you know, that if you're not, and corrupt is maybe a, well, maybe it is the right word to use, but it seems like if you're not corrupt, you become corrupt. Because even if an officer sees somebody else doing something wrong, if he tries to report it, he too will usually get blackballed. Has that been your experience?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with HPD. I mean, you're either one of the boys in blue or you're not. You know, that's the way they see it. You're either one of us or you're none of us.
Now, if you will, I know it may be uncomfortable to talk about, but who are those people? As I understand, and correct me if I'm in error, you and your wife had been separated. Is that right?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
And you had gone over to her apartment thinking you'd going to reconcile. Is that right?
Yeah.
And
I didn't go over there to reconcile.
Right.
It was reconciled earlier in the day.
Oh, it was. Tell me about that.
I'd taken her out to lunch, and she told me that her so-called girlfriend, Ruthie Money.
Is that her roommate, Ruthie?
Yeah.
Okay.
They weren't getting along, which is pretty much the average between her and Ruthie, because Ruthie is an alcoholic.
You'd known Ruthie before, I take it.
Right. And Ruthie was an alcoholic. She sold marijuana. You know, she did everything she could possibly do. I mean, she was a what I call a homophobic prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And she had these guys come over there and pay her bills. And if she's in a, and she even picked up a name, and they called her 18-pack Ruthie.
My gosh.
As long, you know, as long as you had an 18-pack of beer and, you know, a carton of cigarettes, well, you could have her all night long.
Sound like a key truck stop girl to me.
So.
We better explain what we mean by key truck stop girl in the Cheating Heart Motel. That was a place out in that neighborhood where all the hookers hung out and all the women hang out. And,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Anyway, you talked to your wife earlier that day, and then what happened?
She told me that she wanted me to come back home because she didn't want to live alone. So I said, all right, I'll come back home. And I said, but it's going to be after work. And I never did go to work that day. I just took off the rest of the day. I went back home, and I sat there, and I thought to myself, something's not wrong. Something isn't right about all this stuff. Something's terribly wrong.
In what sense I don't follow?
I don't know. I just had a gut feeling.
Okay.
You know, something told me this was not a good thing. And...
You mean her being separated or her calling?
No,
you
her
what?
Calling me back and wanting
okay.
to come back over
okay.
there. Because she hadn't wanted to be back over there. And then all of a sudden she wanted me back
over
there.
I see.
And she had made a remark one time to me that, you know, she was going to try to kill me.
Okay, I see.
And I kind of thought about that, too, even sitting there in my house. I said, wonder if she's going to try to, you know, have somebody jump me or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what happened that night. I mean...
Now, when you get over there, I think her roommate was there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of guys there, too, weren't there?
Yeah.
Now, I think there were a total of, what, two men and there's two women. Is that right?
No, there were three men.
Three men, okay. And I know that. Did one of them come later or all three of them there when you arrived?
No, one of them come a little bit later.
That's what I thought. I thought there were two guys there, then the third one shows up. What time of the day or night is this?
Well, it began about between 9:30 and 10, and... When I got there, when I walked inside the house, I asked her, I said, what's all this?
Did you know the men?
I had no earthly idea who they were. I mean, she tried to tell me, well, you remember Kelly Hazlitt, you know, from Baytown?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I don't remember. May have been one of her friends. It wasn't one of my friends.
I got you.
So... And if it was one of her friends, it was probably somebody that she had been in bed with. But it all began between 9:30 and 10. And I sat there long enough to have three or four beers.
What were they doing, just sitting around drinking and talking or what?
Yeah, mainly just jacking their jaws, not about much, nothing, anything.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, I finally... decided that enough was enough. I'd had enough, you know. She didn't really want me to come home because if she had, these people wouldn't have been there. And she had already went into the bedroom with one of these guys, and I told her girlfriend, Ruthie, I said, well, when she comes out of there, you tell her I left.
So you're just planning to leave when she went back in the bedroom with this guy.
And I said, and tell her don't be calling me and don't be bothering me. And I said, because I said, I'm done. I'm through. This is it.
Oh, I don't blame you.
And I walked outside. Just as I was fixing to walk outside the house, a knock came at the door. I opened up the door, and who would be there? None other than the dope dealer, the kick burglar, and the horror thief in the neighborhood.
You're kidding me.
So, I mean, I knew this about this guy. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, well, they told me to come over here and party with them. And I said, well, you have fun. I'm leaving. So as I walked out, he walked in. But Ruthie told him, don't let him leave. Because if he leaves... he's going to bring the cops back over here. We've got dope in the house. We don't need no problem with no police over here.
I see. So Ruthie, okay.
And there was like a freezer bag of dope in the towel rack or the towel compartment in the bathroom that I'd found, because I don't walk into nothing blindfolded. I went into the bathroom, and the first thing I did was I looked in where the towels and things were kept, and there was half a freezer bag full of cocaine and a big old rock of hard cocaine in the center of it. And I didn't say anything about it. I knew what was going on when I got there, and the dude that was on the couch, he was already kind of basically high to begin with, and I noticed that right off the bat. But when I left, I got into my truck, and I was just about to stick my truck keys into the ignition of the truck, and this is when the car thief came out and said...
That drug dealer that appeared earlier, right?
Yeah, this guy's name was Tony Cruz, or Antonio Cruz. And he came out there and said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to the house. Where else am I supposed to go? I'm not going to sit here and be a part of all that in there." I said, "You know me better than that." And he said, "Well, they don't want you to leave." And I said, "Well, I'm going to leave." And he opened up the truck, tried to pull me out of the truck. And from that point on, it was kind of like the fight was on.
I got you.
And he was just a little old skinny, scrawny dude. I mean, he probably didn't weigh 180 pounds at the most. And but I didn't want to hurt him. I mean, I'm the type of guy who would just take my wrath out on you. I mean, even though I was drunk or stoned or buzzed or whatever, you know, I just told him, "Get off of me, leave me alone." And apparently I didn't realize it, but he got my keys out of my hand. That just goes to show you how buzzed I was.
Mm-hmm.
And
hey,
he ran off
high over there at the house with the rest of them.
Yeah,
okay.
He ran back inside the house. So when I got back in the truck, I reached up there and was going to turn the ignition on, and there weren't no keys. So I said, "Well, I must have dropped them." So I got out, felt in the floorboard, and they weren't there. I felt up underneath the seat, they weren't there. And I said, "Well, he's got them. He's got to have them." So I thought, now why are these people wanting to keep me here? You know, why do they want to keep me here?
Well, I would imagine what you said. You'd figure you'd call the police on them.
So I said, "Well, there's something screwy going on. I'm not going to take no chances with it." I pulled my deer rifle out because I carry guns with me regardless. I mean, I either had a handgun, a shotgun, or a rifle on me. I had a gun on me somewhere. In this case, I had been working hot shot. I was going in some bad neighborhoods, and I was carrying big payrolls with me.
So hot shot, you mean just delivery stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was delivering a lot of large amount of money, like $35,000 to the bank, and making bank deposits for companies and stuff like that. So I thought, going into these bad neighborhoods and stuff that we have to go into to pick up some of this merchandise or deliver it, I'd just go ahead and I'd start carrying a rifle. So that's what I did. In the meantime, I went back into the house, and just as soon as I went through the door, I told Ruthie, I said, "Look, y'all need to go on and give me my keys back." I said, "You got my keys? I want my keys." I said, "I'm leaving, and I'm going home." And I said, "Just leave me alone." And she said, "We're going to kill you. We're gonna kill you and throw you in the back of your own truck and take you off and dump you off in a bar ditch somewhere and leave you for dead." That's Ruthie. I mean, she just runs her mouth a lot. You know, she's a lot of hot air. I didn't put too much to it. And I told her, I said, "Look, you're sitting here talking to a guy who has a loaded weapon in his hand. do you really think I'm going to let you kill me? And she said, well, and she took a beer and she just threw it in my face. When she did, I shot her.
I understand.
And she jumped up at me while she was doing it. And I didn't know whether she was trying to attack me or whether she was just getting comfortable, but she threw beer in my face.
Did they submit a self-defense charge in your case?
No.
They didn't?
Mm-mm.
Okay, go ahead.
As far as I know, they didn't. They didn't tell me if they did.
Because normally when something, you testified at your trial, didn't you? And you told them basically the same thing that we're talking about now, right?
No, because I wasn't allowed to talk about any of this.
You're kidding me. Who stopped it?
Prosecutors wouldn't allow me to bring it up. You know, they wouldn't. In fact, they wouldn't let me say anything that they didn't ask me. You can only answer questions. You can't.
But didn't your lawyer bring it up?
Nope. He didn't try to bring nothing up.
Well, that seems logical that you'd want to do that if someone tried to attack you and threatened to kill you and threw a beer at you and you reacted to it.
I looked at him when they started. Every question they asked me, I'd turn over there and I'd look at him to see what his expression was to get some kind of reading off him. And it was like he was playing poker or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wasn't giving me any indications of go ahead and tell it or don't go ahead and tell it, shut up or whatever, you know.
Well, you told him all of this ahead of time, didn't you?
No.
You didn't get a chance to, or what happened?
I didn't tell him all this because I didn't trust him.
I see.
And he tried to tell my dad. He said, I know he's holding back on me. And I said, yeah, there's a reason for that. I said, because I don't trust him. And he said, well, he belongs to the Masonic Lodge, and he's a good man. And I said, and you just think that everybody in your Masonic Lodge is just wonderful people, huh? And he said, yeah, they are. And I said, they never done anything for me. And I said, I don't see them out here helping you right now. And then when he did go to the Masonic Lodge and ask for help, the so-called worshipful master told him, oh, we can't help felons.
Okay. Now, you shot her, and then what happened after that?
Well, she started yelling, what'd you shoot me for? What'd you shoot me for? Well, it was obviously why she got shot. And then right after she was doing the these two guys got up off the couch, they started running toward me, and I shot them. And when I shot Cruz, the bullet hit him, and it just literally picked him up and set him right back down where he'd been sitting. And Rogers was headed toward me when I shot him. The bullet went up his arm, through his armpit, and out his back, and it blew out his shoulder blade. And a .30-06 don't play around. It went in probably with a hole the size end of your, if you got a watch, the watch crystal, and came out the size of a softball or bigger.
That makes sense.
When it hit all the bones and stuff. And he ran out to the yard screaming, call the police, he's killing everybody. Well, I guess I was, you know, seeing that they charged me. I didn't know what they were going to do. And as far as I'm concerned, they were after the gun. They got a hold of the gun, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Exactly.
And everybody there died within just a very few minutes.
And your wife was shot, too. Where was she?
She was in the bedroom.
Doing what?
Oh, she was having sex with this dude in the bedroom. And
was that after you had shot
the dude? Yeah, the gun had rung off three times in the living room. And, you know, this house wasn't very big. It was only like, say, where you're sitting over there to the end of the bathrooms over there. It wasn't very big at all. It was less than 800 square feet. And just went in there, kicked the door open because the door was locked, and she realized what was going on, I guess. And she hit him in the chest with both of her hands. And she hit him so hard, he bounced up off of her onto his feet at the end of the bed. And then she tried to roll off the bed. And as she was rolling to get on the floor, I shot across the bed at him. And, of course, that's when she got hit in the hand with a slug. I mean, I wasn't aiming at her. And I didn't intentionally kill her. They just, you know, you can't control bullets, what they do once they when they leave right. The muzzle. And, I mean, she's in the process of rolling off, hitting the floor. And, of course, the prosecutor, he gets up there and tries to say, oh, we know she was holding her hand up in the air telling you, no, don't shoot. And you shot anyway. No, I didn't do that. That's a lie. I mean, that...
Well, he wouldn't know it either because there's nobody there that said that.
So. Well, if I'd had any snap there, I would have said, did you have a video camera hidden in the house somewhere? Do you know all these facts? How do you know everything I did? I'm the only witness that you got, and I'm telling on myself right now. And I was perfectly honest with it, basically. You know, I didn't have any problem telling them what happened. And I really thought that I thought I was justified in everything I did.
Okay, and I also understand that you went back out of the house and put the gun back in your gun rack mm-hmm. and waited for the police.
Yep.
Didn't try to escape or anything, did you?
Nope. When they got there, they wanted me to lay down on the ground. I wouldn't lay down for them. And they said, you need to lay down on the ground. I said, I'm not laying down on that wet ground. I said, you want me? Come over here and handcuff me. I'm not going on anywhere. I'm not going to do anything.
How long did you have to wait for them? You could easily have escaped.
Probably 7 minutes.
Okay.
It wasn't very long.
Now, are you confined in jail the entire length of time?
Yep.
Never made bond?
Who can afford, you know, like $1 million bond?
And they did you ever try to get the bond reduced? Did they ever try to do
Yeah,
that?
They reduced it down to $100,000. Who can afford $100,000?
I understand.
You know.
How long did you have to stay in jail before you went to trial?
6 months. Okay. The following June, the trial started.
As I understand, during your trial there, the state used a jailhouse snitch and informant. Would you tell me about that?
Yeah, his name was Philip Eugene Jones. And he come to me one afternoon. They had put me up into what they call the drug addiction section of the jail, where they try to help these people, supposedly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they put them through a 12-step program if they've, you know, been dealing with alcohol. Well, seeing that my case involved alcohol, well, they put me through this 12-step program. And I didn't mind it. It was no big deal. It was pretty comfortable. And I didn't have to put up with a bunch of nonsense or nothing. So, and I had a cell to myself, and I liked that. So this other dude, the snitch, was in a cell by himself that they'd put me in there with. And he came to me one afternoon after my first day at trial, and he said, you need to do something about these people that are testifying against you. He said, or they're going to kill you. And I said, now what in the world would I want to do to them to make them stop saying anything that they're going to say? He said, well, I know a guy that can kill them for you.
You're kidding me.
And I said, really? He said, yeah. And I said, I said, well, I don't think we need to go that route. I said, I think there's been enough killing done. So he said, well, if you don't do something about them, they're certainly going to kill you. And I said, well, they're going to kill me regardless. I said, I can see that right now. I said, I've already seen the paint on the wall. I said, it's red. I said, I'm done. And he just said, well, just think about it. And I said, I'll think about it, but my mind's not going to change. So the next day when I came in, about an hour after I'd been there in the little pod that we were in, he comes over there and he says, I got a guy on the phone wants to talk to you. I said, okay, whoever that might be, I'll talk to him. Got on the phone, and that was Gary F. Johnson, the so-called Harris County hitman.
So I presume he was an undercover cop. Acting, really a cop acting as a hitman, right?
Right. So he got up there and he said, I understand you need five people taken out. And I said, who told you that? And he said, well, Philip told me that. And I said, Philip don't know what he's talking about. And I said, do you realize? I said, you do realize Philip's in jail, right? He said, well, yeah. I said, you do understand these phones are being taped.
Same
you know,
thing.
The phones are being taped right now, correct? I said, you do realize that. He said, no. And I said, yeah, they are. I said, every word we're speaking of right now is being taped. Well, I don't need to be talking to you, click. And he hung up the phone. Well, that pissed him off because he'd been caught trying to entrap me.
Of course he was.
So, of course, when they tried to go downstairs and get the tape and all that, well, the tape had been conveniently edited. No tape. No phone call. No record of any phone call coming or to or leaving that pod.
Little Richard Nixon trick.
Sure. So, but he had recorded what he said, and he brought it to trial, and of course he told on himself.
But did he testify at trial that you wanted him to kill some people?
Yeah.
And of course you couldn't rebut it because there's no tape.
Right. And I told him, I said, that's not what I said. I told you that I didn't want anybody killed and that you needed to leave these people alone. I even asked you where these people lived. Did you know where they lived? And he said, well, I'm sure their names were in the phone book and I could find them. And I said, that's correct. And I said, and I told you to leave them alone. I said, I didn't tell you to go out there and kill anyone. So they still used it against me.
And so the snitch testified and the undercover so-called hitman testified.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had any more contact with that snitch since then?
Yeah, he wrote me one time and told me that, hey, if you need help, well, I'll be glad to testify on anything, but I'm not going to lie for you. And I thought, you already lied. Why in the world would I want you to lie anymore? You know, you weren't any help to me. You idiot, you put me here.
Anything else about the trial you want to mention other than that?
Nothing except for the fact that the trial attorney just, you know, he was a very arrogant guy. He was full of himself. And, you know, he wouldn't listen to anything I had to say. He wasn't interested. As far as he was concerned, it was open and shut case.
You know, you had at least a shot at the Court of Criminal Appeals, four dissenting opinions in your case. Womack wrote the major one, as you well know, and of course you got Mansfield, who was just not much smarter than the Cocker Spaniel, that wrote the opinion. So
it's amazing how some of these people are appointed and stay in positions, and you know.
And see, the bad thing, and I think you'd agree with me on this, one of the bad things about it, when you come back with an 1107 writ after a direct appeal is over with, guess who hears the writ? The judge who heard the case, generally. And they've already got their mind made up ahead of time because they've heard all the facts before, and that's not
right.
Fair. You have some appellate issues, too. You want to discuss what those are?
Well, I had an Atkins claim filed, you know, in my
And for
case.
Those who don't, Atkins is when they're saying that there's been some problems with being mentally handicapped, not understanding everything fully, and that's what they're talking about, basically, right?
Yeah.
And what happened to Atkins' claim?
They also have a thing up there that if you don't have a speech impediment and you're not winking, blinking, drooling, or you know, look like you've got Down syndrome, you don't qualify. Well, I don't qualify because I'm not winking, blinking, drooling, and I don't have Down syndrome. That doesn't mean I'm not retarded. It doesn't mean I don't have any deficits in my case, but that's like...
Well, one of the things they look at when they look at that, one of the major things they look at are tests done in school, how well you did in school. How'd you do in school?
Well, they tried to say I had a 92 IQ.
Okay.
And there's no way that I could have a 92 IQ because I wouldn't do any of my homework. I wouldn't do any classwork. I was a straight F student. I refused to cooperate in school with the teachers because I didn't want to learn. I wasn't going to learn what they were going to teach because it wasn't going to help me get a better job.
I see.
And I told them this. And that was my argument right there.
How far did you go in school?
Eighth grade.
And you quit at that point, right?
Didn't quit. I didn't quit then. They quit me.
I see.
They had a meeting with my parents one day. My dad went to school. School counselor had a meeting with my dad, and the principal had a meeting with him. And they both said, we don't know what's wrong with him, but at this point, we're tired of him. We want him out of school. He's not going to turn out to be nothing. And you need to put him in some kind of vocational school to where he can learn a vocation and take him off, because they said, at this point, we're just babysitting him, and we're not babysitters. And we cannot continue promoting him through school, and that's all they had been doing. Straight F student through school. All through school, made nothing but Fs. And here I am, got a 92 IQ somehow or another. Never did any homework, never did any classwork. Fought them all through my schooling, and yet I've got a 92 IQ. Where is the 92 IQ?
I can understand. Okay, as you realize, and this is a morbid thing to talk about, this will be played only if you're executed.
Mm-hmm.
You realize that. Is there anything that anybody want to mention, anything you want to say, anything that we can do to make this at least for the ones that love you more understanding, the ones that are supporting you more understanding, and make you feel better? Anything you want to say?
Well, there's a lot of people who want to meet me, and that I haven't seen in over 20 years,
uh-huh.
And I'm having a hard time getting them in right now because they took away they're supposed to give you something like 30 days that you can see all these people so you can change your visitation list a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
Well, they've narrowed that down to 14 days. So instead of giving you 30 days, they give you 14 days now. Well, with all the people that I want to see, I don't have 14 days to see them. And the major here, he's not one of these people who's going to change your visitation list or allow it to be changed every time you turn around, which in this case, that's what's supposed to be happening, and it's not happening. So that needs to be changed, and they need to give us at least 60 days. I mean, the execution order was signed October 2nd. And I've been over there in death warrant since October 2nd.
Over there, meaning in Huntsville, or where?
No, over here.
Over here, I got you.
And so I've been here on a pod, on death watch pod, and that needs to change. They need to give us at least 60 days where we can have our visitation changed, so we can get all these people in here that we want to see. I mean, some people have large families. I have a large extended family. I don't have any direct kin, but they're all friends of mine.
I see.
And most everybody that I know, they're all ministers. That's another thing in life, that I didn't hang out with a bunch of thugs and thieves in life. I hung out with spiritual people, holy rollers, pastors, preachers. And, you know, nearly everybody that were my friends were either pastors, ministers, assistant pastors, or they were cops.
Mm-hmm.
And I had about as many friends that were cops as I had many friends that were ministers and things of that nature. So,
and they haven't been, all of them haven't been able to see you, right?
As of right now, they haven't, because they won't change my visitation list until 14 days out.
Okay. Yeah, well, so, you realize they may be able to hear us on this program. Is there anything you want to say to them, or do you like to say it this time?
Yeah, they need to change that rule.
Okay.
As far as my treatment here, I tell you, the food is atrocious. And these sergeants up here tell you, well, you have to eat what they send you. No, we don't. And they know they don't. We used to have a sergeant up here by the name of Miss Stringer.
And
every time Miss Stringer would find this food to be unacceptable, the tray's not to be hot, she'd send that tray carrier back over there to the kitchen. And, of course, it made that kitchen captain all upset, been out of shape. But you know what? They need to get their acting gear over here. They need to get it right, and they're not getting it right. And now there's so many people upset with these, right, with the rank and stuff up here. Nobody wants to come to work here.
None of the guards do?
Man, there's guards walking off from this place left and right. We just had one guard here the other day. Her name was Miss White, and she beat an inmate with her slot bar because he wanted to exchange his shower towel out for a good shower towel. And she refused to let him have a good shower towel. And he said, well, I'm not accepting this one. And according to the rules, we're supposed to be able to examine our towels, examine our sheets. And if they're cut up or they're tore up, we're not supposed to accept them. We're supposed to have good sheets. All we get is all this cut up, tore up stuff around here.
Okay, I've just been given a signal. You just got a few minutes left. Anything you want to say in parting?
Well, I will tell everybody out there that Elvis ain't dead yet.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I just wish I could have met you earlier. I wish I was able to practice law back when you first called me. I just wish I could have been able to have helped you.
Well, I heard, you know, kind of, sort of, through the grapevine what had happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you would have been a great racehorse, Haynes.
Well, I appreciate that so much, and I just wish you the best. And thanks so much.
Same here.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, still, Elvis is not dead. The last word we have is there's a procedure that was pending somewhere in the universal ether. It was beyond the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, maybe before the Fifth Circuit or maybe beyond. But as of this moment, we have no reason to believe Elvis is dead. But to give you some idea how well organized they are in Huntsville, they had the media cross the road and go into the witness booth for the media. But then before Elvis's designated witnesses crossed the road, everything stopped. And then they called the whole thing off, and the media had to come back out from across the road. Jim, do you have any idea how to speculate on what's going on in Huntsville?
I have no way of knowing. One thing and two things I want to correct. Number one, I read a lot of these cases, and Wayne Hill did a tremendous job, contrary to what McCoy says. And I read the opinions, and I could not think of anything he didn't do. And number two, they did, in fact, submit a self-defense charge. He was mistaken on that. And I also think he's mistaken on being critical of Wayne, because Wayne did a tremendous job on this case.
But Wayne's got a reputation for being a pretty good lawyer.
He's a good lawyer. And he, on this job, he
whoever was in second chair, that other fellow's pretty good lover.
Both of them are good lawyers. That I would, you know, that I don't agree with that.
Of course, Loper may have a little more experience under his belt now than he did then.
Anyway, but Wayne, like I say, Wayne did, I read that opinion. He did everything you could possibly do and some stuff I never thought of. So I thought he did a great job.
Paige, do you have any speculation on what might be going on?
I have absolutely no way to speculate. It's not apparent from the information that we've received anything going on but a hold. And we don't know who's in charge of the hold or when the hold will, if ever, be lifted.
Larry, is God going to make it through the night?
We have no way of knowing, Ray. I can't.
You were a little bolder with the microphone off than you are.
Well. He's not in a good position, Ray. I mean,
no.
I don't know what the holdup is, but sometimes these things, once they get started, and I can't see any reason why they wouldn't continue at some point during the window that they have. That's
they
my,
got from
my
now
guess.
Until, the window is actually from now until 10:30. But it's actually legally until midnight. But TDCJ has said we can't do this if we have to start after 10:30. And so that's where we stand. I mean, you've got what the law says, and then you've got what is practical possible. And so we've got almost 7 o'clock until 10 o'clock for include. But for if you're listening to this show either live, and boys on the row, especially you, Coy Wayne, Elvis still alive. That's the last thing he said on the interview, is he's still alive, and that's best information we've got from here. This is not an exact business. The taking of human lives, I mean, all of those out there who've tried to kill themselves realize, wait a minute, this is not as simple as I thought it was going to be before I started. Because automatic urges set in and you can't do things that you thought you could do, and life lingers on. And the legal system works the same way. Elvis is lingering on. While people who dress a lot better than he ever dressed in his lifetime are sitting around talking about, let's take this angle or that angle. Trust me, I carried a case where I talked about two cops' relationship with their mothers all the way to the Supreme Court and saw the finest legal minds in this country talking about the relationship between cops and their mothers and whether you could say that or not. So I know that the details of this to a layperson seems pretty extruded. But right now, Elvis is alive. Right now, there's something pending somewhere that is sustaining that.
Ray, one of my biggest concerns, though, after hearing the interview, and this goes just completely across the board in all criminal cases, I was concerned sure. with Westbrook talking about not telling his lawyer what the details of his possible defenses might be because he didn't trust him. That's about the worst thing you could do. I mean, if you don't have a good relationship with a lawyer, you need to get another lawyer, do something different. But that's the person who's in the best position to help you. So that's not a good thing for him to do, not trusting his lawyer, not telling everything to the lawyer. That's critical. This is, you know, not necessarily for him right now, but because it's probably a foregone deal for him right now. There's nothing to do. But you have to cooperate with your lawyer. You just really have to tell your lawyer everything.
Jim, was this case properly charged in the first place?
Well, we're going to talk about that because one of the things, and Ray, I think we're going to talk about, number one, Paige is going to talk about how self-defense doesn't work. And Larry's going to talk about why he got convicted because his only defense was pulled out from under him because of the procedure we have. It was tried under the law, but it was one of those classic cases where a guy is guilty, but procedurally and through the courts, they were executing a man that should not be executed, in my opinion.
Okay, there's a clock in front of you. Strike out, Paige.
Okie dokie.
Don't burn it all up because you got a speaker after you.
I know. Anyway. Speaking about self-defense, in a nutshell, self-defense involves reacting with deadly force when the person who ultimately is the killer is presented with the use or the threatened use of deadly force. And it can't just be a threat that's thrown off. Thrown out by the soon-to-be decedent. But it has to be a threat that apparently has some sort of backing. Now, in this particular case, if we take everything that Mr. Westbrook says as being true. And reading the appellate opinions involved in this case, it does appear that he said he outlined the facts very well and very, very consistently with what the appellate record was. Anyway, based on the facts in this case, it does not appear that even though the woman he called Ruthie threatened deadly force, that there was any apparent ability to carry that out based upon what Mr. Westbrook said.
Well, don't they apply a reasonable man standard to that decision?
Yes.
And is it not credible that Coy may not actually qualify for reasonable man?
Well, part of me wants to think that because I find in this particular case, even though five bodies ended up on the ground.
Yep. He even miscounted that. He said there were four and he killed five.
He shot five and killed four.
Shot
there were five on the ground.
Okay.
Killed four.
Anyway, even though there were as many decedents as there were, I still, part of me still wants to say that because of sudden passion, because of a potential claim to self-defense, which was ultimately rejected by the jury, the issue of self-defense was presented in punishment.
Okay, Paige. God is clock, and so I've got
yes,
the interview.
Sir.
This is Ray Hill. I'm the host of Execution Watch. I want to thank the legal team, which includes Paige, you just heard, Jim, which you heard, Larry, you heard. We got two more in the wings that didn't get to play tonight, and that's Jack and Mike. I want to thank Danielle, who was our Death House reporter. I want to thank Jennifer Simmons, who was our vigil reporter. Our executive producer, of course, is none other than the capable Elizabeth Stein, who is in the other room on the telephone trying to figure out what the hell's going on, because that's her job to know that. And, of course, our computer wizard and the technical guy that made it possible for you to listen to this all over the world tonight is Otis McClay. We're very lucky to have Shannon in there sitting at the board doing excellent work. Our next execution date is the 22nd, and it's scheduled to be Adam Ward. Texas is killing them on a pretty regular basis. I hate doing this show, but I love having you out there listening to me. If you have any comment about it, you can get in touch with us directly on my email, HillRay@sbcglobal.net. Coy, hang in there, son. We hope you make it through the night.